We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Plenty to cover. Starting out with local and cameras, red light cameras.
Red light cameras, yes. Tim Iman has supported citizen initiatives in cities all over the state to ban red light cameras. Well, the Mukilteo Citizens Initiative that was passed just in the past year to ban...
Which was one of his first, because he lives in Mukilteo.
To ban red light cameras, Proposition 1 went to court this week, and a state Supreme Court judge ruled that this Proposition 1 to ban red light cameras may not be able to go through. What he said is that the state legislature gave city councils the ability to use red light cameras. They didn't extend that ability to the electorate. In other words, local voters can't contravene a state law. What would be required is not a local initiative, but a state initiative in order to ban red light cameras in the entire state of Washington, not just in specific cities. And that's a well understood and a very common type of legal ruling.
Yeah, state laws that involve regulations and zoning and police power and that kind of thing are usually exempt from initiative. So this is something that Tim Iman, who has made his living from initiatives for over a decade
should know. Yeah,
yes.
He should know that.
Probably does know, to be honest.
Yeah, and what was interesting in this decision, too, is that the dissenting judges weren't really bothered by the majority ruling. In other words, if they had thought that the lawsuit was important, they would have probably ruled the same. They dissented because they thought the lawsuit itself was moot, since the Mukilteo City Council had already gotten rid of the red light cameras in response to the citizens' initiative. So they said, really, the lawsuit doesn't need to go forward. But I want to point out, though, the majority judges were right to continue to hear this case and to make the ruling, because 25 other cities and towns in Washington use red light cameras, and there are other citizen initiatives underway. The most current are underway in Wenatchee and Redmond, so it's not going away.
Also, Monroe just passed one.
And Monroe, Bellingham, and Longview also passed advisory votes on red light cameras. So, yeah, it's a current issue, and the judges were right to continue to hear the lawsuit and rule on it.
Yeah, now this is something I may not ever say on this program again, so people should pay attention. I actually agree with Tim Iman on this one, not on the substance of the red lights per se, but on the fact that the laws should be subject to initiative, and communities should have the right to control their own regulations on things like this. But the law is what the law is. The ruling was correct, and Iman should have known better. And he raised money for these initiatives basically on false pretenses, which is not something new for Tim Iman.
I don't particularly agree with Tim Iman on this. I don't think local communities should be able to contravene state law. You'd have a problem going from one town to another just trying to figure out what the laws are in Redmond versus Kirkland versus Bellevue. There's a reason why localities can't contravene certain state laws, and so I agree with the judges on this ruling.
All right. Well, perhaps we will revisit this again in the future.
Oh, I'm sure we will.
All right. Moving on, liquor privatization update.
Yeah, there was another ruling this week. A Cowlitz County Superior Court judge ruled that I-1183's provision, that's the liquor privatization initiative that just passed, I-1183's provision to direct $10 million per year to public safety programs may have influenced voters to vote for something that they otherwise wouldn't have approved. Now, the Costco, I-1183 is commonly called the Costco initiative, because Costco put...
bought it.
Yeah, pretty much bought it. They put $19 million into the initiative. That was the sum total of what they spent. It was the most expensive ballot issue in the history of Washington State so far. That's not to say we won't have another Costco-type initiative come up in the future. But the judge ruled that he would hold a hearing on March 19th to decide if the initiative is really about two different subjects. And most of our listeners know that, but just want to remind you that in the state of Washington, initiatives can only be about one subject. They can't be about two things.
And Tim, if you're listening, this one's particularly for you.
Yes. So if he does rule that, yes, the initiative was about two separate things, then the whole initiative could be struck down, and that could put a wrench in the works for liquor privatization. Now, the plaintiffs in this lawsuit is the Washington Association for Substance Abuse and Violence Prevention, plus a couple of stores that currently handle liquor under contract for the state. The case is clearly going to be headed for the state Supreme Court, but they would need to rule by June 1st if they want to prevent the liquor privatization from going forward. And I just want to point out that this week the state put its liquor stores up for auction, all 167 of them, on an online auction system.
Yeah. So this will be fast-tracked for sure.
This should definitely be fast-tracked.
Moving on, developments this week regarding our state budget.
Yeah, as we mentioned last week, late on Friday night, a week ago, the Republicans, with the assistance of Democrats in the state Senate, pulled a procedural coup and inserted their own state budget over the one that the majority of Democrats had been backing, even though the alternative budget had no public hearings, no amendments, and no chance to be vetted by the public.
So literally, people, state senators, were voting for or against something they hadn't read.
Absolutely. And that passed. And so what we had this week with the state house passing its own budget and rejecting out of hand the Senate budget is we will be going to a special session, and that special session will require the Senate budget and the House budget to be reconciled. Now, this is a little tricky since the Democrats that control the Senate don't particularly want to advocate for the budget that was passed over their objections. Republicans and the three rogue state Senate Democrats have threatened to strip Seattle Senator Ed Murray of his chairmanship of the Ways and Means Committee if he does not advocate for the Republican budget. So they're very much playing hardball on this one. The problem with it is that the state, the Senate budget, which would have to be used as a basis for compromise with the House budget, absolutely decimates education funding, social service funding. It's a very, very harsh cuts budget.
Yeah, it does away with Disability Lifeline, which is the state payments for folks who don't qualify for Social Security, people who are literally unemployable. And if you cut those folks off, then we're going to see a lot more people out on the streets.
Yeah, or dying.
Dying.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it is a brutal budget, and now would be the time, while we wait for the special session to convene next week, now would be the time to get a hold of your representatives, both senators and House, and demand that the House budget be the basis for the one that is passed by both chambers. And particularly if you have one of the three state Democratic senators that jumped, or a Republican state senator, you would strongly urge them to not back the alternative Senate budget that passed, because it's extremely destructive to the state economy and to the needs of people who need state support the most.
Yeah, and I find it kind of interesting that this week we had the two Republican candidates making very controversial statements about higher education and about the expenses of higher education. And here we are in this state, we're going to cut another...
Presidential candidates.
Presidential candidates, yes. Here in this state, we're going to cut another 70-some million dollars from education.
Which has already been hammered. And
yes,
even when the state is already under a court order to improve their providing of education, because they've been so deficient in it in recent years, primarily because of previous budget cuts.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on to national news, and Eric Holder giving a speech this week.
Yeah, Eric Holder speaking at Northwestern University on Monday, giving his first rationale for the Obama administration's assassination in Yemen of an American citizen a few months ago. And basically he has not given any detailed legal rationale. That memo has been kept top secret, this being the most transparent administration in history, TM. Basically what he gave at Northwestern was a trust us defense of executive assassination, claiming that, this is a direct quote, due process is not the same as judicial process. That is, the Constitution requires due process for anyone accused of a crime, but it does not require, according to Holder, a judicial process. Technically, he is correct in this, and what he's referring to in this is the Supreme Court's Hamdi decision in 2005, but that decision requires that detainees, I hate that word. They're prisoners. Mm-hmm. And this is a quote from the Supreme Court: a fair opportunity to rebut the government's factual assertions before a neutral decision maker. Now, that decision maker could be a secret panel if you are concerned that the evidence that you have, if released in public, would pose national security concerns. But if you have the process that Holder and others have described for the assassination of Al-Awlaki, the process basically is a secret panel that is convened at the direction of the president that makes recommendation, and the president goes yay or nay. But the person who is being deliberated about here doesn't even know that this process is going on, let alone knowing what the charges might be, what the evidence is against that person, with any confrontation with witnesses, if there are any. There's no public record of deliberations or decisions, and there's no law or court that's governing their operations. They're just making this up as they go along. And what they're saying is, well, we haven't abused the process so far because this guy that we shot in Yemen was a very, very bad man. Well, or actually, we didn't shoot him. We bombed him from a drone. But
along with several other
people. Along with several other people who, oddly enough, were not threats to the security of the state. But a couple things about that. Number one, when you're setting a precedent like this, you almost always choose somebody extremely, extremely unsympathetic in order to set the precedent. For instance, when the federal death penalty was reinstated, Timothy McVeigh was the first person who was shot, who was executed. The second person who was executed was a Mexican national in Texas for whom there was a lot of serious concerns, both about his guilt in the crime and about the process by which he was denied representation by his embassy. Similarly here, you have a very unsympathetic first victim, but it sets a precedent. Similarly, you may trust Barack Obama or Eric Holder to make wise decisions about U.S. citizens who should and shouldn't be executed without any public or judicial process. But you may not trust President Santorum or President Romney to make those same wise decisions. If you've had sex and you weren't married and it wasn't to your opposite sex spouse, maybe President Santorum will decide that you are an enemy of the state. What are you going to do then? Because he'll cite President Obama as his precedent, and there's really not a whole lot that anybody can say. You know, a lot of the people, a lot of the Democrats who were very, very critical when President Bush used surveillance without any court oversight for accused terrorists. Now Obama is assassinating them without any court oversight. A lot of those people are very conspicuously silent, and that's outrageous.
All right. Moving on to another speech this week, this one given by President Obama.
Yeah, he spoke to AIPAC, the pro-Israeli lobby this week, to try and chill a little bit all the talk about war that the Israeli government and allies of the Israeli government in the U.S. and the U.S. media have been talking up these past few weeks. A lot of sort of careless talk about how dangerous Iran is, and I say Iraq, I meant Iran, and how dangerous Iran is and how we need to have a military strike against them and how there really is no other alternative and the only question really is when. Well, Obama, in trying to appease that lobby and also making the point, of course, that war is a serious thing and you can't just casually sit around in your Georgetown cocktail party and talk about it as though nobody's going to suffer, He did that at the cost of committing the U.S. to preventative and illegal war should Iran actually get a nuclear weapon or more specifically, and if the U.S. thinks or Israel thinks that Iran might have such a weapon. And that itself actually is a violation of international law, a war crime, because it's a preventative war. We're talking about Iran getting a weapon. We're not talking about them using it or attacking the U.S. or Israel in any way. That actually, speaking of precedent, before George W. Bush, would have been unthinkable in U.S. foreign policy. And now, again, we have Obama ratifying modifying the radical precedent set by Bush and expanding on it. And now we're talking about the U.S. committing a war crime. And actually, under the U.N. Charter, it explicitly prohibits not just an unprovoked military attack on another nation, but also the issuance of threats of such an attack. So even Obama's speech this week was a violation of international law. And yet it was, that part of his speech was almost entirely unremarked upon by an otherwise very widely covered speech. It's become a new norm in the U.S. that we commit war crimes, that we commit violations of international law, that we launch wars of aggression, unprovoked wars, and that nobody thinks twice about it. It's very, very sad. But again, because you have a Democrat ratifying what the Republicans were doing previously, it's then considered uncontroversial by most of the political establishment in this country.
Of course, the standard line, regardless of party, is that the U.S. is not subject to international law. We set our own precedents, and we follow them. Now, you could argue, too, that the George W. Bush administration set a precedent for this, too, with the war in Iraq, because we were not attacked by Saddam Hussein.
And that worked out so well.
Yeah, we were not attacked by Saddam Hussein, no matter how much the Bush administration tried to prove that there was a connection between Osama bin Laden and the government in Iraq and Saddam Hussein. They never were able to do that convincingly. And the arguments for a war in Iraq boiled down to, well, they have weapons of mass destruction, which you could argue, again, is the same argument they're using now for Iran. Iran may get, in this case, may get a weapon of mass destruction. We don't really have the proof of that yet, but it's very similar.
In fact, most of our intelligence agencies are agreed that they're not trying at this time.
Yeah, that they don't have the evidence that they're trying at this time.
Yeah, and you've also got people on the right, in addition to trying to prove the weapons of mass destruction routine, they're also trying to make a link between Iran and Al-Qaeda, based primarily on... Yeah, even though one is
Sunni and the other is Shiite,
and they hate each other.
the same problem that they had with trying to make that connection with Saddam Hussein.
And the main connection is that Iran has a number of Al Qaeda terrorists in their jails, and the folks on the right are trying to claim that they're in their jails because they're cooperating with them. It's kind of counterintuitive.
Well, you can make that same argument with Republicans here in the United States who have very similar social policies to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And we have a lot of Al-Qaeda operatives in prison here as well.
Yeah. Are we going to talk about Rush Limbaugh, by the way?
Oh, yes, we are. That's next up here. We're going to talk about Rush Limbaugh. He was under fire this week for having spent 3 or 4 days attacking a female student who testified to Congress about how the U.S., the federal government should require that employers who provide health insurance to their employees fully cover women's contraception. Now, Rush Limbaugh proved this week that he does not understand how birth control works. He's completely and proudly ignorant of the fact that in order for birth control to work, you have to use it every day, even if you're only going to have sex, say, once a year. Now, apparently, there are a lot of Americans who don't understand how birth control works. Approximately 50% of the pregnancies in the United States are unplanned pregnancies. So apparently at least half of the U.S. population, men and women, don't understand how birth control works. And it's a public disservice.
Or don't have access to contraception, or in the case of men, yes, don't care.
Yes. And so it's a public disservice to have someone as popular as Rush Limbaugh making misstatements about how birth control works, clearly proving that he doesn't know and doesn't want to know. Now, I also want to point out, too, what Job just said. Women typically need to use birth control for about 30 to 40 years of their natural lives, but it's expensive. It can be expensive. A generic version of the pill, you pay about $9 per month, which is a total of about $108 per year, or about $3,000 to $4,000 over your lifetime. That's the cheapest option. For a brand name pill, many women can't take generic pills because they have side effects to the generic options that are out there, and they end up having to take a brand name pill that has a lower side effect profile. The brand name pills can cost as much as $90 per month, or over $1,000 per year, which equates to about $30,000 to $40,000 over the course of a woman's lifetime. And other options like a patch or a ring or or implants, they fall somewhere in between those two options. The most reliable birth control that's available for women is the long-acting versions of birth control, like an IUD or an implant. Those, however, are the most expensive to pay for up front. Usually for an IUD, you have to shell out $600 to $1,000 or more just to get the first...
It can be more than that.
Yeah, just to get the first IUD or the first implant. Those are the most reliable options because women don't have to remember to take them every day. And those are the ones that are the best at stopping unplanned pregnancies. So clearly, and you know, they also have the lowest side effect profiles as well. Women don't often have them removed after they get them. So it's not really just about having fun, as Rush Limbaugh would have you think. It's really about quality of life issues as well as having control over your own body.
Yeah.
But it's also an economic issue as well.
The exciting thing about the response has been the response to Rush Limbaugh, in that the public has been so outraged by his attacks on a private citizen. And it wasn't just, you know, one or two misstatements of word, as his sort of not really apology would have implied.
Repeated attacks.
Repeated a total of 70 times over 3 or 4 days, as Maria said. That a lot of people, even for Rush Limbaugh, this was a mile too far. And his advertisers have been fleeing him in droves. As of Thursday, something like 75% to 80% of the advertisers were missing from his online streaming of his show, and they were filled by public service announcements instead. A lot of very, very large advertisers, Geico, Proflowers, Sleep Train, a lot of the sort of staples that you hear on AM radio, Sears, have decided to disassociate themselves from Limbaugh's program, at least until the furor dies down. And it really is a testimony to the fact that when you get a certain critical mass of people who decide this is an abomination, you can have an economic impact on programs like this. The place to really target now, and this would be true in Seattle as well with Bonneville, who owns KTTH, AM 770, where Rush Limbaugh is broadcast in Seattle, would be to target the program directors of these individual radio stations, because generally they're corporate managers, because most of these stations are owned by large corporations that own several stations in a market. They don't really care that much about the content of these different programs. What they care about is the ratings and the advertisers. And if advertisers are skittish and listeners are outraged, they can find some other right-wing shock jock. They don't have to broadcast Rush Limbaugh. So contact KTTH, contact Bonneville Broadcasting, which also owns Cairo Radio, and let them know that you don't think this kind of discourse has any place in Seattle.
All right. Speaking of distasteful, on to recycled food.
Yes, another recycled food horror story. It involves pink slime. The USDA purchased about 7 million pounds of pink slime to be used in the school lunch program. What is pink slime? Well, it's beef filler, or it's the trade name for it is lean beef trimmings. It is banned for human consumption in Britain. McDonald's restaurants don't use it. Taco Bell has banned it from its restaurants, and it's commonly used in dog food and chicken food. What is it? It contains ground connective tissue and meat scraps treated with ammonium hydroxide. And it's put into about 70% of the ground beef sold for human consumption in the United States. So when you go to the supermarket, chances are about 70% of what you're getting in your ground beef patties that you're going to make your home-cooked meal with is pink slime. Yum. It's not really meat. Connective tissue can include tendons, ligaments, and skin. It doesn't have nearly the nutrient value of meat, and it does not have healthful ingredients in it if you think about all the fat that may be in there. In addition, ammonium hydroxide is added to kill E. coli, and once it hits your digestive tract, chances are it is going to kill a lot of the beneficial bacteria that you need in order to normally digest your food. And of course, now the USDA has approved it for use in the school lunch program. So not only do we have the USDA allowing a food processor to recycle moldy applesauce for our children to consume, they are also now consuming pink slime as well.
Although the school lunch program goes primarily to poor people, so, you know, that doesn't really matter.
That doesn't really matter, right?
All
oh,
right.
My God. So also for a food quality issue this week, the Center for Science and the Public Interest released a report showing that they had found Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, Diet Coke, and Diet Pepsi to contain a high amounts of a carcinogenic chemical called 4-MI. It's included in caramel coloring in the soda. So it has nothing to do with the flavor of any of these beverages. It has solely to do with the color and the look of these pops. And now Coca-Cola came out and said that they're going to change the formulation to try to get rid of 4-MI from its beverages. But if you're not sure that they're actually going to go through with that or that they're not really serious about it, you could try Dr. Pepper as an alternative. It had very low levels of 4-MI, although any level of 4-MI would probably be a cancer risk for, particularly for children. They are heavy consumers of diet sodas and regular sodas.
All right, let's jump to international and talk about Iran.
This week, the U.S. and the six nations, Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China, decided that, yes, they would accept Iran's offer of resuming face-to-face negotiations. But, of course, typical for the six nations, they didn't come out and sit down and say, let's talk about the parameters, let's negotiate how this is going to work, what are the inspectors going to be able to see, etc. No, the U.S. representative of the six nations came out and said, no, we want, in order for these negotiations to go forward, we want complete and unfettered and immediate access to Iran's biggest and most busy military base at Parchin, which is near Tehran.
You know, the kind of base that might be key for defending against a U.S. or Israeli attack.
Yes.
Hmm. All right. Anything else on that? Or we can move on to the U.N. Commission?
Yeah. A U.N. official within the U.N. Commission on Human Rights, who oversees the investigation of torture, Juan Ernesto Mendez, issued a report this week calling Bradley Manning's incarceration at Quantico last year cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. Now, Manning, as you probably remember, is the Army private who was accused of leaking a couple hundred thousand different U.S. State Department cables and other documents to the whistleblower group WikiLeaks. Manning was held 23 of 24 hours each day in solitary confinement for 8 months, stripped of his clothing and forced to stand nude for morning inspection, kept on suicide watch after psychiatrists concluded he was not a threat to himself, and was otherwise routinely harassed by his captors. And again, this now... labeled by the UN official investigating torture, concluding that this kind of treatment fell within those parameters. Now, Mendez has also repeatedly complained that his investigation was obstructed by the Obama administration. That kind of obstruction, something that almost never happens to UN investigators, even in the worst human rights violators in the world, China, Iran, Saudi Arabia, etc. The Obama administration, with that, as with the extraterritorial assassinations, as with the loose talk of war against Iran, aggressive war, showing itself once again this week to be an extreme human rights violator. Very sad to see.
All right, events.
Yeah, several of them this week. Today, there are a couple of different celebrations of International Women's Day, which happened a couple of days ago. From 11 to 4 o'clock at Westlake Park, downtown Occupy Seattle, we'll be having an International Women's Day rally. And then from 2 to 8 p.m., there will be a meet and greet and then workshops for International Women's Day with a lot of different co-sponsors. That'll be held at the Asian Counseling and Referral Service Building at 3669 MLK Way South in Seattle. And then next Saturday morning, first thing, from 9 o'clock all the way till 3 o'clock, various speakers and workshops on lessons from Fukushima for the Pacific Northwest. My mouth really works. Honest, it does. That'll be keynoted by living legend Helen Caldicott. That'll be at the University of Temple United Methodist Church at 43rd and 15th Northeast in the beautiful Seattle U District.
All right, talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.
Yes, and you can also find some of my articles at mariatomczyk.com.